You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face, incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people. Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that often lift and or separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, we would like to welcome you. David and I are old friends. We have talked about movies pretty much our entire lives, and now we do it for the masses. This is an unscripted podcast. We come to you remotely from different states, even.
What?
We decided we wanted to cover not just a few horror science fiction movies, but broaden the span to a century worth of horror and science fiction movies. We do a couple per decade each season, relatively, and we deep dive into those amongst our many little side shows you may have seen out there. I am here with my good friend and co-host, David Horton. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Pretty good. Yes, I think. Let me check. Yes. Good. I'm good. Good intro. That was great. We do want to welcome everybody. I'm glad they're all here. We normally start with what have you been doing in your genre week? And mine is a little different because it's really not a genre week, but it was a big movie week and it was an interesting revelation for me. So I finally caught up on the very last James Bond movie. I'm a James Bond fan, always have. I even put up with the Roger Moore years and have really liked the new direction it's taken with Daniel Craig and the producers and the way they've done it and everything else. And I had heard really glowing kind of reviews over the last James Bond film, came out in 21. It was called No Time to Die. And much anticipated. It had been delayed over a year, of course, for various reasons, and then COVID and all that, and finally came out. Interesting cast. So you had Daniel Craig, you had Ana de Armas, who I think is just gorgeous, and Rami Malek, hot off his appearance in the musical. What was it?
Bohemian Rhapsody. Queen.
Bohemian Rhapsody, yeah.
He won an Oscar for that, didn't he?
I think he did. Yeah. And all really good things being said about it, and I left this movie thinking that it was my least favorite Bond movie other than some of the Roger Moore ones, sadly. I don't want to give away any spoilers because if you haven't seen it, if anybody out there hasn't seen it, you definitely need to see it. It does complete essentially this quadrilogy or this trilogy of the Craig era as Bond. It has all of the bells and whistles needed. It has great cinematography. It has incredible direction. It was actually directed and co-written by Cary Joji Fukunaga. And I think you've heard of him because he co-wrote It, both movies.
The new
ones. So he was one of the co-writers of It. And he's done some really great like television stuff. Like he did The Alienist. He adapted that Caleb Carr book and turned it into a series, and it was really good. At least the first season. I didn't watch the second season, but the first season was really, really good. And he's got really good cred. He's done a bunch of True Detective. He's been executive producer for like, I think, 3 seasons of that show. So he knows his stuff, and it's a very well executed movie. I just didn't care for the plotting and some of the cliches they added into it. They kind of went back to, oh, we have to have this, or, oh, we've got to do this. And part of it being this feeling of agenda. I mean, without saying it, I mean, the early press I'd read when it was in production in like 19, I think, was this would be the last Daniel Craig, and they're setting up a female black actress to be the new James Bond.
I thought it was either a female or a black actor, but yeah, I know where you're going.
And I went, okay. I remember us talking on the podcast even then when I first saw it, saw the news and everything, and I was talking about, no, that's not James Bond. That can be a secret agent. You can be a 00 even. Be great. Do your own story, but don't say that's James Bond.
It could be Idris Elba. He's British.
Yeah, and he's not James Bond. Not anywhere near what the author originally intended for that character to be. So, anyway, okay. Moving on. They don't do that, however. They kind of set it up. At the end of the last James Bond, Bond essentially quit and went away. And in this one, it starts with him being still retired. And when he gets called back into the service, of course, like most James Bonds do, or any secret agent story from the cold, come out of the cold, come back in. He finds out that they've reassigned his number to another agent, and her number is 007. So there are two 007s, and I liked that. I thought that was a clever way of doing it, without it being, oh, we're replacing you, essentially. But cast was so strong, and I'll probably watch it again just to see if I could maybe like it. I just didn't like the way it went and what they did with the characters. So
I've seen one since Casino Royale.
You really should. They're very excellent. I mean, Quantum of Solace is really strong too.
Skyfall.
Skyfall is probably the best Bond movie ever.
Oh.
Probably. Yeah. I would think so, which is sad because then they do this, and to me, it's the least James Bond movie. So Spectre is good too. So all of them have been really good under this direction and this regime. Yeah. Of Bond.
Is it, how many has Daniel Craig done? Five?
Five. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah. And I'm sure they'll carry on and there'll be a new Bond and there'll be something different and we'll see what they're
complaining about it like a whiny little baby.
I will, because it won't be James Bond. No, never mind. But that's what I did in my non-genre week.
I think James Bond should be a drag queen. I could handle that.
No, that is not anywhere near what he should be.
No, but if they wanted to do an Austin Powers kind of spoof on it, it would be pretty funny if he was a drag queen.
Oh, yeah. Totally agree with that. And Austin Powers is great. Yeah. A perfect spoof or parody of Bond. And I like what they've done with Craig in this. They addressed all the issues. So he's not, you know, the womanizing sort of flippant character that all the Bonds have been in the past. He's much more serious, much more similar to the Ian Fleming James Bond,
okay.
I think, than anyone other than maybe Timothy Dalton or Lazenby. So I think they did a great job of preserving Bond. Just don't destroy it now by saying, oh, he's going to be a drag queen. No, or whatever.
Wow. What have I been doing in my genre week?
What have you been doing, Tim?
Well, I went back down, and I haven't been there in a while, down the halls of Shudder, and I watched a little movie called Influencer. This is a new movie. I would not call it a horror movie. It's more of a psychological thriller type movie. Came out in 2022. I really liked this movie. It kept me on my toes. Every time I thought I knew where it was going, it took a sharp turn left and completely surprised me, which is great.
Okay.
Yeah. It is filmed mostly on location in Bangkok, Thailand. So the scenery was definitely new and kind of exotic. It's directed by a guy named Curtis David Harder. And I was like, I don't know who this guy is. But then I looked him up and realized he's a Canadian director that directed a movie about a gay couple that I watched on Shudder called Spiral. And it was good, too. I watched it several years back. So I do like him. So he's obviously a pretty good director that's on just a teeny little blip on my radar now. The cast is great. It stars Emily Tennant, Cassandra Nod, and Rory J. Saper. I will say this not out of meanness, but just so that you may recognize her in the future. Cassandra has a very large birthmark on her face, and it's a bit distracting at first, but she elected, or her parents elected, not to have it removed. She went on and became an actor, and it actually does kind of play in a little bit to the plot of this movie.
Okay.
But she's beautiful. She's just got a very large, I guess, mole or straw. It's not a strawberry mark because it's not red, but it looks almost, at time, when I first saw her, I thought it was a mask and I went, whoa. And then I realized, oh, okay. I did some research. Anyway, a synopsis is, while struggling on a solo backpacking trip in Thailand, a social media influencer, Madison, meets CW, who travels with ease and shows her a more uninhibited way of living. But CW's interest in Madison takes a dark turn. That's not the best summation because it sounds predictable, and this movie is not at all. So, but it is, it has modern plot devices or modern story, you know, because social influencing has not been around very long, obviously, in the last couple of decades. So it's fresh. What I guess I'm trying to get at, it's got a fresh plot, and it only gets 92% on Rotten Tomatoes, but I say that's a fair score. I mean, it kept me entertained. So,
Okay. I wish I'd watched yours instead, maybe. Maybe I would have liked it.
Maybe. It's not a spy movie, though.
No, but it's very interesting. I think it's ample time somebody kind of used that job description for a film or whatever, influencer sort of thing.
Well, I think I told you about a movie last year called Sissy, and it dealt with social media as well. And it was a great Australian horror film.
Okay.
That it dealt with social media and different types of gender fluidity, that kind of stuff. So anyway, I like seeing that kind of stuff now because it's getting more prevalent in America or in the world's conversation, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I think the non-gender, you know, non-binary, multi career path too, is doing a variety of different things. And mm-hmm. Like 20 years ago, influencer would not have been a job description, you know, for anybody.
No, not at all.
But neither would be, you know, YouTuber as an ER. Like that's your job. You make YouTubes.
Right. And you basically get paid via advertisers.
Yeah. But that's your job, whatever you want to vlog about sort of thing. So it's interesting. I mean, that's kind of a, that's a weird we could segue with that because multi hyphenated job title characters are in this film we're doing today.
Wait,
this should be an interesting episode for the two of you, I think. We are doing a film from 1984, and in case you didn't know and didn't see the title in the title above, it's The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension. We're going to be introduced to some very, very eclectic, unique characters, and we're going to be fighting red electroids from the planet 10. This is a science fiction film, sort of. Yes, I guess you would call it science fiction. We distinguish it as science fiction for us, but it also has a great deal of other kind of elements to it. It was definitely a child of its time. So if you don't appreciate 80s films and 80s photography, you probably won't appreciate this film. We'll get to the plot in a second. But I wanted to start by saying, what's your reaction to this film? When's the last time you saw it? When's the first time you saw it? That sort of thing.
I've only seen this movie once before, and it was back in the 80s on videotape, and I am not entirely certain that I finished it.
did you this time?
I did. I did finish it this time. I just remember this being really big on a friend of ours, Lee Russell's list of great movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally disagree.
And I totally disagree. Thank you so much for playing.
This, I will say, yes, I think to Lee's credit, this is the type of film he loves. Now, also to Lee's credit, he's also the guy that turned me on to Bubba Hotep, which I never would have watched if he hadn't mentioned it. So, so there's that too.
Well, I would have made you watch it on this podcast.
Yes, you would. And we did. So there. But it's not for everyone. It's a very mixed bag. I have to say myself that it's hard to follow in places. It has some very unique things, but I think there's reasons for that. And let me cover those first before we go into the plot. So production of this has a weird history. It basically, W.D. Richter was an actor, a writer, had done a variety of things, a producer, kind of stuff like that. His wife read a review of a novel called Dirty Pictures from the Prom. This was like in 1973, 74. So this was 10 years before the movie was made. She found this novel. She read a review of it. She really liked it. It turned out that it was written by a guy named Earl Mac Rausch, and both Rausch and W.D. Richter went to Dartmouth together. So they're alumni. And so she says, hey.
Well, that's a coincidence.
Yeah. She says, hey, this guy who went to your college wrote this novel. Why don't you look him up? Blah, blah, blah. So he read the book. He loved it. He sent Rausch a letter. They started corresponding with each other. Finally, he ended up moving Rausch out to L.A. where they lived. He gave him 6 months of rent. And he said, hey, I want you to write some scripts for me. I want you to write a screenplay for me. So Rausch pitched this idea of this character he had called Buckaroo Bandy. And Buckaroo Bandy basically was this modern Renaissance man who was into everything. He was a PhD. He was a rock and roll artist. He was also all these different things.
A scientist.
Added to a scientist, a physicist, all of these. And the first treatment he did, let me check my notes. The first treatment he did was called Find the Jet Car, Said the President. That was the title of it. And he developed it. He wrote it. It was like a 30-page treatment, so to speak, and then just kind of bailed on it and said, no, it's not going where I want. I'm going to start again. Over the course of like the next 6 years, he wrote like 24 scripts, but only like 30% of the script. He would write and write and write and have all these cool ideas and all this greatness, da, 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 and then just kind of the project. I don't like this one anymore. Shelve that one, do another one. So since the movie has come out and gotten a little bit of a cult following, some of those have been turned into comic books. Some of them have been turned into like pseudo novellas, that sort of thing. All of these weird cases that Buckaroo handled. But for W.D. Richter, he was not getting a screenplay out of a guy. He was going, I got to do something. So that's why eventually when this script was made and greenlit, they took elements from all of these other little things and just threw it all together in this. And that's, I think, why it resulted the way it has, which is
disjointed.
Very disjointed, very convoluted plot, very kind of hard to follow, because talk about immediate stress. You are thrown into this and not given any backstory on anybody.
That's the least of my problems with this film.
Okay, let's talk about it. What are problems with your film?
Well, it's what you said. It's convoluted and hard to follow. And because it's hard to follow and I get exasperated, I stop caring about it. I also think it's and I don't know how. I guess back in the day, maybe these people weren't as famous as they are now, but this is a buttload of talent in a movie that just seems squandered to me and wasted. I even like Peter Weller a lot more now since I saw him in that Cabinet of Curiosities thing from Guillermo del Toro last year.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, yeah, I didn't realize Peter Weller's this good. So I was kind of waiting or wanting to watch this with him in it. And John Lithgow is amazing. Jeff Goldblum is amazing. Ellen Barkin is amazing. But they are not amazing in this movie at all. And I don't think it's because of their talent. I think it's because of the script. So
yes, I concur with you. I would never put this on the 100 list. I wouldn't put this in my top 500 films of all time, you know, sort of thing. I do think it's worth a watch, but that's really about it, just for the excess of it. But here's the way I kind of portrayed it, and I have got this, and it's an early key, but this is a Ken Russell movie with restraint, is the way I kind of viewed it. It like has all of these incredibly crazy, weird ideas, but they're done with this 80s mentality rather than just going and doing them. A lot of people have described this as Doctor Who, as very Doctor Who-like, because they'll just throw anything out.
I mean, I don't watch Doctor Who, but now I never will.
not the reboot. The reboot's different. Okay. Well, or not reboot. I call it the reboot. But since the 2000s, when it came back with Gaddis and everyone else doing it, much more streamlined. But yes, for a few decades, it was just whatever, while, you know, a washing machine is attacking us kind of thing. Well, the washing machine turns out to be a sentient alien in disguise kind of thing. It's that kind of bizarre science fiction that's just thrown in there for whatever. So that's pre-production. They eventually, MGM UA took a chance. They greenlit it. It started in production. And then suddenly the writer's strike happened and everything had to shut down for almost a year.
Wow, what a coincidence.
Ironically, yes. That just happened last year. So that kind of shut everything down for a while. But it came back. And I thought it was interesting when doing some research on this, they talked to Weller about it, and one of his quotes was, "I finally did this movie because I thought to myself, could this be a movie that catches people sideways?" And I thought, yes, that's an interesting quote, and yes, that's very true. I think it does. From the very beginning, this movie catches you sideways and just keeps catching you sideways. I mean, Lithgow is amazing in it, in that first two scenes he's in, and then we don't see him literally for like 35, 40 minutes of the movie.
Right.
And I'm going, why don't we use the villain of the piece? I mean, Christopher Lloyd's great, but he's not John Lithgow in this, not as Lizardo, you know. So
I kind of interpret what you said differently, though, to catch someone sideways. It sounds to me like he's just looking for a hit movie.
Yeah.
Like, this doesn't look like a hit movie, but it could potentially be because it's so strange.
Correct. And I think they all were. I think they all were looking for this to be a hit, so much so that in the final credits, it mentions a sequel.
It does. And like I said, it attracted a lot of strong talent.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Little cameos, little everything, some really good people. But my first six watch notes are, this is such an odd movie. It has odd credits, odd music, odd font in the credits. The production design is odd. The costume design is odd. The casting is odd. So that's it. That's just, were there scenes, any scenes that you actually liked or that stood out or you thought, oh, that one would have been good, but, or whatever?
Not really. Like you said, I'm serious. I mean, this movie challenged me because it had me questioning how I watch movies. I mean, like this movie, like last week we did Demons, which is a low budget Italian horror movie that really is not a great movie. And yet I enjoy it immensely. This movie is loaded with talent, cost a lot more money, and it bored me silly. So you see what I'm saying? So it's like, what is it about some movies, whether they be low budget matinee stinkers or whether they be comedy genre pieces, which there are some I do like, most I do not, and this is no exception. Like, I'm not a big fan of The Third Element or The Fifth Element, but I think it's better than this movie.
Okay.
And you see where I'm going with this? It's really hard for me to nail what it is I'd like and don't like about this movie. Well, I don't like very much of it at all, but I'm trying to see, why can I watch a low-budget movie like Basket Case and be thoroughly entertained and not with this?
Well, I think there's more of a straight through line in both Basket Case and Demons. So it's easier to kind of go along with their plotting no matter what they are.
Gotcha.
In this, they throw in so many asides and so many other elements and so many things. And there's no real focus of what's happening. We don't get a clear reason of what the villains, i.e. the Electroids, are doing and what they want to accomplish, really. And then we don't really see the emotional impact of Buckaroo wanting to stop them or do it, you know? So there's not a, and then the love interest they throw in is, it can't be a simple, oh, I think she's pretty. It's got to be, you're a twin that was abducted at,
of his ex-wife or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Or his ex-wife.
His dead wife.
His dead wife, yes.
And she's his twin. I mean, that's like, what? That's just stupid. And I don't know.
Well, smash everything was stupid too, but we still
it is, it. But it's funny.
Well, to your point, yes, we still, well, but Jeff Goldblum is funny in this movie. I mean, come on.
Well, Jeff Goldblum is pretty much funny in anything. And I think that John Lithgow just chews scenery up in this movie too.
Oh, yeah. And has a, you could tell he's having a blast doing it.
I agree with your thing though. I think that maybe that's what it is. Even a low budget bad movie has a plot you can follow, whereas this is just filled with distraction. Like the whole rock star thing to me seems self-indulgent. I'm like, why does he have to be a rock star too? Is this just to cash in on the music of the 80s or what, you know?
Partially, yeah. That was kind of always it, is that's what allowed him to see the entire world and go on tour and not be stuck into a lab or something somewhere, mm-hmm. because he had to go out with the Hong Kong Cavaliers and do his concerts and stuff and his clubs the concert they show literally looks like they're in a basement somewhere. I mean, they're in somebody's basement.
It looks like a small club.
But it's interesting because I thought the same thing, and then doing some research on this, found out that Neil Canton, who was one of the producers of it, got really uber involved after the writer's strike and when they started photography, to the point of looking at rushes saying, cut that whole scene. I want a new scene. I don't like that scene. And W.D. Richter was just, you know, a new director just starting out. He had never, ever directed before. Earl MacRouse, the writer, had never written a screenplay before and gotten it produced. So they both were kind of kowtowing to Canton all the way through it. So he would cut things, he would change things, he would want to add stuff, and they would end up having to accommodate that. And then I found out that about a month or 6 weeks into shooting, they still had like 3 or 4 weeks to go of shooting. Suddenly they stopped getting all these notes from Canton. And so they started thinking, maybe he's checked out. So to do it, they started inventing scenes and doing scenes or throwing in lines or throwing in a character that wasn't even in the original screenplay just to see if he would complain. And he never did. So they said, oh, wow. You know, and it was like, you know, kids in the candy store now kind of thing.
Yeah, I read
one of those. One of those being the scene where New Jersey, the Jeff Goldblum character, and the other guy are walking through, and he just has the line where he goes, wait, why is there a watermelon right there? And he goes, never mind. And they just keep going through the scene. They did that entire scene just for that one line. And that was all made up on set to do just to get Canton to cut it. And he didn't. So it was that kind of thing. Throwing crap in there like that just to, for either whatever production political reasons you have or whatever, doesn't help your audience experience of the plot.
No, not at all. And let me ask you, I'm glad you find it humorous.
Not at all.
Not at all. Simpsons. Well, I get it that this guy wrote a novel, but this was not a novel, was it?
No.
Okay, because it feels like it's some, it reminds me of the indulgent comic books of the 70s, like Howard the Duck and these just crazy things that it's like, you know what, I never did care for those. So that's, I don't know. It gives me the same feel. As a matter of fact, I'm going to put that as key. Howard the Duck.
It is. I think it could have been. I think it probably should have been. If Roush had been directed in his life path toward doing comic books rather than novellas, screenplays, whatever he was trying to do, it probably would have been more successful and probably more streamlined in what he wanted Buckaroo to be. I mean, there's literally, there have been games, there have been comic books, novellas, all kinds of strange things in the Buckaroo Banzai world.
Yeah, I knew it spawned comic books. I just wondered if it was, if it had maybe come from comic books, and I don't think it did.
No,
yeah.
Never did. Nope.
No. So it's, it, I don't know. There's that. It's just very hard to explain. And you and I both have issues with comedy genre mixings. I mean, there are some exceptions. I think Shaun of the Dead is a great exception. I think Galaxy Quest is a great exception.
Yep.
But there are movies like this that when they're doing sci-fi, but they're also trying to be funny, and they're also, it just, it's like, let's throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think much stuck at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do have certain memorable things to this movie. To me, not necessarily scenes, but
memorable things. Yeah, go ahead. We didn't do scenes, so.
Would be, of course, the introduction of Lizardo and the way he's electrocuting himself in front of the television and just totally, as you said, chewing the scenery. Lithgow is just unplugged, literally, in this whole movie. He even added like a weird kind of funky crab walk that he does, so he doesn't do a normal walk like everybody else.
Right.
I think, you know, the line, we used it in our trailer, a lot of people use it, the...
Because, remember, no matter where you go, there you are.
Now that you mention it, the scenes that stuck out to me were probably more comedic than science fiction. Like, yes. The scene I remember the most is when Ellen Barkin is unconscious and he goes to kiss her. And right when he gets really close, there's a little electric flash because she shocks him and it throws him back. And it just reminds me of like in the wintertime when you're petting a cat and it wants to touch your nose and it gets shocked.
Oh, so good comparison, yes.
You know what I mean? That made me laugh. And that scene sticks out to me more than any other scene in this fucking movie.
I would agree.
The opening's interesting where you're like, oh, he's going to drive through a mountain. You know, that's a pretty interesting concept. So I'll give him that. You know, it's a hook.
Yeah, I do think the opening actually works and establishes all of them fairly well. You know, we always talk about a character's entrance. Well, they're talking about Buckaroo, 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 and he's late, and we're getting the test ready, and the car's ready, and yada, yada. And then you cut, and he's doing brain surgery with Jeff Goldblum in time to get, and it has to finish in time to get to the site to do this. So I thought that was kind of compelling, kind of interesting. And then it immediately went off the rails because we cut and we're in outer space and this weird ship is coming down and we don't know what is happening. And it just, I remember Ellen Barkin's thighs from this just because they seem to like them a lot and they play them up a lot in the photography of this movie. And I remember in the 80s going, wow, she's great in this movie.
Her what?
Her thighs. There's always showing her thighs. She's got a cutaway dress that shows her thighs and her legs and everything else. When they put her on the table, they're putting a spider on her legs.
That's right. You know, I misunderstood you. At first, I thought you said size. Then I thought you said sides, S-I-D-E-S. And then I realized you're saying thighs. I'm like, okay. I was like, her size. Her sides, her. I think she's great in this. I don't know that she was just coming onto the scene in the 80s. And the one thing, and this is going to sound very gay of me, the one thing I really loved was her haircut. I thought her hair looked awesome. Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen her with hair that short.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Not anything else she's done.
And to me, she, out of everyone in this movie, including John Lithgow, who is just over the top, I think Ellen's probably the strongest actor.
Oh, yeah. And I think this movie is just a huge This is a timely piece. If you want to know what the 80s were like, watch this movie. Even the opening credits of On the Train, just looking at everybody and the hairstyles and the music and the costume. Because the music to this is all synth. It's all electronic all the way through.
Well, it reminds me, remember those Charles Band movies we used to watch that were like low budget B movies that were sci-fi? That's what this feels like to me. It's like a, it's a Charles Band movie with an A-list cast.
Agreed. Like Time Cop or whatever those were that were all those Charles Band movies. Very good comparison. That's a great
terrible kid. Terrible movies with people you didn't really know in them, or Jeff Fahey or Richard Lynch
or Michael Paré or whatever.
Except this has A-list actors in it. So I was like, that's confusing in itself too. It's like, I feel like I should be watching this movie, but it's got a good cast. So
And a big cast. I mean, I remember reading that Robert Ito, he petitioned to do this professor. He wanted that part really badly.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
Well, no, and Clancy Brown's in it. And we mentioned, I mean, we were talking about The Boys and Gen V before we started today. And I was and Clancy Brown's in that too. I mean, he's still around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So
I mean, can move on to cast if you're
sure.
Or did you have any more like production stuff?
No.
I mean, the only thing I had was I didn't really know who Richter was, and I saw that he did the movie Late for Dinner. That's really the only movie I know of his, I think, or know of. And then Roush, I don't know anything. Well, Roush wrote New York, New York, the Robert De Niro, Liza Minnelli movie, and he wrote A Stranger Is Watching, which is the Carol Kane horror flick, you know, with the call is coming from inside the house. And he wrote Wired, the John Belushi bio. So he went on to write, I would say Roush wrote more well-known movies than Richter has directed. So that's surprising. As far as cast, there's one other famous face that was in this movie that got cut. Do you know who that is?
No.
Jamie Lee Curtis was in this movie.
Oh, yes, I did hear that. Yeah, she was his mom or something?
Yeah, she played his mother in a flashback, Buckaroo's mother in his flashback. But the scene was deleted, and you can watch it on the recent DVD release as an optional prequel to the theatrical version or something. I don't know. Anyway.
Oh, wow. So Jamie, okay.
Yeah, Jamie Lee was in this movie, even though she's not. This film, I mentioned that it has a lot of heavy hitters. Well, it includes three Oscar nominees. Jeff Goldblum, Peter Weller, and John Lithgow have all been nominated for Oscars. Peter Weller, who plays Buckaroo, has stated that his inspiration came from Elia Kazan. I don't get that at all.
Okay.
Adam Ant, which I get completely because he looks like Adam Ant, and Jacques-Yves Cousteau.
Jacques Cousteau? Well, I guess.
Elia Kazan, Adam Ant, and Jacques Cousteau were his inspirations for Buckaroo. And I can think is one's a rock star, one's an oceanographer, and one's a film director.
And a well-known oceanographer. So, you know, he invented things and did stuff. So he was more of a, I could see that as the Renaissance man sort of thing.
Right. I mean, it seems to me like he said, I'm going to pick, you know, three guys in different occupations and I'm going to base my character on them. And the only thing that really works is Adam Ant, man, because he looks like Adam Ant. I was like, at times when he's singing, if he just had a little bit of makeup on, I would have thought, that's Adam Ant. Two other people were, two other people were considered for the role. One, I think, would have been better. One is Tom Hanks, who I don't think would have been better.
Right.
The other is Michael Keaton. And this is a Beetlejuice-esque role that I think he would have chewed up along with John Lithgow. So Michael Keaton was also considered for the role.
I can see that.
Peter Weller probably got it because Tom Hanks and Michael Keaton's agents said no.
No. Well, I read somewhere in my notes, I mean, I read somewhere in research that they wanted Weller because they needed that kind of youthful look, but also somebody who could play everything from the intensity of Buckaroo without being offensive. So he could be a physicist, neurosurgeon, test pilot, all this macho stuff, but still appeal to people kind of thing. Which, again, I think you're right. I think I think Beetlejuice would have worked for that as an inspiration.
Right. But yeah. Tom Hanks is what you just described, universal appeal.
Right, but Tom Hanks is too nice, I think. He would.
I agree. I think he would have been miscast.
Yeah, and he could not have done the rock star part, even though I don't think Weller did it well either. So
not really. John Lithgow, I mean, a lot of these people I don't have any information on as far as other cast members because no one else wanted to do this movie, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. Or they were just handpicked. John Lithgow plays Lord John Warfarin and Dr. Emilio Lizardo. He, to me, is one of the best things in this movie. Second and right up there with him is Ellen Barkin, who played Penny Pretty, which is a very strange and, I don't know, intentional name, I'm sure. Jeff Goldblum, who would normally be in my top picks, is still up in my top picks, but I think John Lithgow and Ellen Barkin are just stronger than him in this. Christopher Lloyd is in it as John Big Booty. There's another one of those intentional names.
Bootay, Big Bootay.
Christopher Lloyd is a good actor. He needs to be in specific parts. And around this time, I'm not sure he knew what to do. Had he done Back to the Future yet?
Yes.
He had? Okay.
Yeah.
Because
that's a huge key for this movie.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, I think he's kind of wasted in it. I don't really.
I do, though, think pairing him with Vincent Scavelli, definitely they both look like they could be aliens. So well, I think
and
that
they
worked.
Both were in Cuckoo's Nest together.
Yeah. So I think that worked for me.
Yeah, I like Vincent Scavelli.
They should have had Danny DeVito as the third guy.
That would have been hilarious if they just cast characters from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. The entire cast, no one else. And Nurse Ratched would have had to play. I mean, Louise Fletcher would have had to play the Ellen Barkin part. Penny
and let Nicholson play the John Lithgow role.
Yeah.
And Billy can be Peter Weber.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Put what's his name that I like so much? What is his name that plays Billy Bibbit?
Oh, he's also the psycho in everything else he's ever done.
He was Chucky, and I can't believe I don't know his name. He's in my favorite X-Files episode. Anyway.
Yeah.
That guy. Lewis Smith played Perfect Tommy, which is another very strange name. All these character names are strange.
All the names are funny. Yeah.
I looked him up because I was like, who is this guy? And he's from Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There was someone else up and cast in this role, but ended up turning it down for a better movie. You know who that is?
No.
Michael Madsen was offered the role, and he turned it down because he was in The Natural at the same time.
Yeah, I don't think he would have been good for that. No. Not for Perfect
Well, he
Tommy.
Would have been more hitman, more scary villain, probably.
I would have used him in the Dan Hedaya role, the John Gomez character. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Rosalind Cash is in this movie as, is it, John? I, as soon as I saw her, I went, oh my God, this is the second movie this season we've done with her in it. Because she is in The Omega Man.
Yep.
Which I enjoyed better, by the way. I could watch that 70s music and Charlton Heston all day. Anyway, Robert Ito played Professor Hikita. Pepe Serna played Reno Nevada. Ronald Lacey, blah, 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 all these people we don't know. And then we get down to Clancy Brown played Rawhide. We mentioned him. Also, did you recognize a familiar face briefly in this?
Well, John Parker.
Yes.
Is Carl Lumley.
Carl
who
Lumley.
Who last year we did Usher.
He is the lead in Fall of the House of Usher. Yes. Yeah. We just covered a piece of his not long ago. And I mean, it's great to see him again. And then you mentioned Vincent Schiavelli. I can't say his name. Schiavelli. who is sadly no longer with us, and I have been watching Moonlighting reruns, and he was at one time married to Alice Beasley, who plays Mr. Pesto, because they met on that show.
Okay.
He was in the first season as a villain, and they met on that show. So,
okay.
And his head, by the way, would squash like an eggplant.
Like an eggplant.
Yeah. That is all I have on cast. As far as award, it was nominated for Supporting Actor by the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Movie Awards, the Saturn Awards. Lithgow was nominated, and Roche was nominated for the screenplay. I don't understand that at all. It is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die list, and I completely agree with that.
I don't think it's on the 5,000 movies you should see before you die.
I don't think so. This is like a forgotten nugget. I wouldn't even call it a nugget. It's an old two in casting.
Let me go back real quick that you didn't do. One was Dan Hedaya, who plays John Gomez. Everybody recognizes him. He's always a mafia thug kind of thing. Okay. Wasn't he one of the husbands in Cheers? He was like the husband to, what's her name? Anyway.
Diane?
No.
Carla?
Carla. Carla's husband. Dan Hedaya played him. And then Yakov Smirnoff, who was
the Russian comedian.
He was big in the 80s. And he's the national security advisor in this. And in the worst scenes. The scenes in the president's hospital room should be taught as this is bad screenplay writing. This is terrible.
That's a great soundbite. This is bad screenplay writing.
It is. And it should be taught that way because they're just terrible. The non sequiturs don't work. The execution doesn't work. It doesn't fulfill the plot at all. There's really no reason for them there. There's no exposition that is given for it other than there's tension with the Russians. Well, we already got that from the scene right before that. Mm-hmm. So, they're unnecessary and they don't work. And I wonder again if that's one of those, let's just spitball and come up with weird ideas just to be weird for weird sake. Like instead of a president scene in the Oval Office where he's meeting with the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor. Okay, great. That works. But no, we're going to put him in a hospital bed. Not only in a hospital bed, we're going to put him in an inverted traction bed.
Yeah, because I guess he had a bad back.
I guess. And just weird stuff.
Yeah.
And it just, yeah. I'm with you. I can appreciate this movie, from a legacy from Lee, but also just for a, wow, at least I can knock that off my bucket list. I saw it kind of thing.
Had you never seen it?
I've seen it once before.
Okay.
But again, I don't like weird for weird's sake. I don't like weird for weird's sake in no matter what genre you're dealing with. Horror, comedy, science fiction, whatever. I don't like just throw it in because somebody will think it's funny.
It's distracting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it takes you out of the story. And that's why I don't. Yeah. It's not good.
It's not good.
No. And you know, you mentioned earlier Ken Russell, but I don't. I was back to what I was saying about reasons I enjoy movies, whether they're bad or low budget or what have you. I enjoy Ken Russell movies because they are abstract and they are like watching art and what Ken Russell does is not distracting. It enhances the picture.
Correct.
So I was wanting to make that distinction before and I'd forgotten about it.
Well, I also saw in trivia and stuff, I saw that the special edition DVD of this has 14 deleted scenes, not just the original, because it was supposed to start with the Jamie Lee Curtis flashback and then go into the whole jet car stuff. But they said there were 14 additional scenes. I went, I can't imagine. That would even make it more complicated.
Well, if he hadn't stopped paying attention, there would have been even more because the guy that was cutting them every day.
Yeah. And I had that totally wrong. Looking back at my notes, I was the wrong. There were two producers, Neil Canton, and then the head of the studio, the head of MGM UA was David Begelman.
he's the one that was making all the changes and requesting all the stuff. And evidently got distracted by another movie or whatever in the last like few weeks of production so they could do whatever they wanted. He didn't interfere at all with the edit, so to speak, once they did final edit and everything else. And this movie premiered and made less than half of its budget.
I was going to ask you because I didn't do the research. How did this movie perform?
It was terrible. It was horrible. It premiered and literally made half of its budget. Let me see if I can, I've got my numbers written down here somewhere.
Well, its budget had to be the actors, I would think.
Well, and also, yeah, effects and everything else. It,
no, the effects aren't that good, though.
Yeah, it had a budget of $13 million and it grossed $6 million total. That's total. It's gross. not a very popular film at all.
Had Peter Weller done RoboCop by then?
Yes.
I keep thinking some of these iconic movies came out in the late 80s, and this is an early 80s. That's why I keep asking things like that, because I can't remember when 84? Those movies came out.
Yeah.
Okay.
So mid-80s sort of ish thing for Mr. Weller.
And then I know that John Lithgow had already done Garp, which he got an Academy Award nomination for.
Oh, I'm totally wrong. That is totally different. Buckaroo was before Robo.
Yeah, Robo was like 87, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Or something. It was definitely, I think, later. But when was Back to the Future? 82, maybe? There were a lot of big movies in 82. So it could have been around that time. Okay. So, yeah, just trying to get a little timeline. Bear with us, folks. I don't have any trivia whatsoever. I do have some keys.
Yes. Some keys would be fine. We could go to keys.
Well, if you have more trivia, I'm welcome to listen.
First of all, let me look up Back to the Future.
You're looking up the films. Here we go again. Whenever we have something we don't care about, we start looking to other movies or talking about other movies they've done. Have you noticed that? We did that with something else last season.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was. But, yeah, it is quite obvious when both of us are
Back
like,
to the Future was in production at the same time as this. It was released a year later in 85.
Okay.
So around the same time.
Christopher Lloyd was in a good movie and a bad movie.
Yep, within 2 years of each other.
In two years.
So there. Trivia. No, I got nope. Nothing here, dude.
All right, my first key is Star Wars.
Why? What? Okay.
I knew that was going to blow your mind. They opened the movie with a crawl, just like Star Wars.
Yeah, but it's an upright crawl. It's not a crawl. Well, shit. It's so key. Does, I mean, Hunt for Red October opens with a damn crawl.
Well, then Hunt for Red October's a key, too.
No. No. It's just because it has a crawl.
It's a crawl.
Okay, I give you. Okay,
it's a crawl, sure. And I'm standing with it because I don't have many keys.
Okay. So you have to have Back to the Future because their overthruster thing looks almost exactly like the flux capacitor, which is what powers the jet car in this and powers the DeLorean in Back to the Future.
Well, I was going to say it's also a car, basically.
Yeah, a car accelerating fast, but that one goes back in time. This one goes into another dimension. Rock.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I've got War of the Worlds because they actually literally mention it in the movie.
There you go.
Majority of it takes place in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, which is where the attack takes place in Orson Welles' version of War of the Worlds.
It's more the it's more the radio drama, though, than the movie, wouldn't you say?
Correct. Radio drama being the influence on it. And they literally mention it. And, you know, the way Goldblum covers it up is he says it really was an invasion. Then they covered it up by saying, no, it was just a radio drama.
Right. So, yeah. Right. They kind of played with the legend of the radio drama itself. Yeah.
Yep.
I've got Flash Gordon serials, not the movie, but the serials that used to be before a movie. For some reason, this has that flavor to me.
Oh, yeah. and that feeling of, you know, Flash was, could be anything or do anything, a multi hyphenate kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Renaissance man, so to
speak. Makes sense.
Yeah.
I've got Men in Black because this has that feeling of you know, an other agency that knows all these things that are going on in the world, except they're in full view. They're not hidden like in Men in Black. They're like, they can go around the world and there's an astrophysicist over here and a rock star over here and that sort of thing.
Those movies became distracting to me too.
The first one I thought was brilliant.
The first one's pretty good, but then they kind of go down the road of Buckaroo to me.
Definitely by the third and fourth one, yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, can't handle. I went ahead and put Bubba Hotep in there because you mentioned it, and it is a comedy-horror hybrid, but it's an example of one to me that works. This one, I can't remember. I put it in here for something else too.
And there's,
I guess, there's a rock star, maybe Elvis.
There's eclectic characters in it and weirdness, but it still works. There's right. funny lines that are asides that in Bubba Hotep actually work, but in this don't. There's no reason for it, and we go. It throws us out of the movie rather than saying, "Oh, that was kind of funny."
And you would think that it would in Bubba Hotep because you have an African American actor playing what he says is John F. Kennedy.
Yeah,
and it actually enhances the movie because of things later said by him in the movie. Yeah. So,
well, and again, it's
the opposite.
It's conviction of screenplay because they. In Bubba Hotep, they're believing what they state. Mm-hmm. In this, there's so much that it's incomprehensible for us to believe everything.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. I guess what I was leading at is that it's the opposite of this movie in that it's effective. But it also has to do with the fact that it's a small plot in a small setting, which I always gravitate to. Anyway, yeah.
I've got
very outrageous characters.
I've got anything by Terry Gilliam. So Time Bandits,
yes.
Baron Munchausen, all of those that again, throw the kitchen sink into these weird ideas of just throwing it. But I think Gilliam is better than Richter and Rausch because he can streamline his plot a lot better and give them archetypal reasons for it. You know, in Time Bandits, the whole point is we've got to get the map back in order to do this. And in Baron Munchausen, they've got a linear story, even though it's told various times and weirdness and with
it's
very strange characters, it's not distracting.
Yeah. I mentioned Howard the Duck. You mentioned Back to the Future. I think the only other thing I have are just keys that I lifted from IMDb. We talked about the names of these characters and how they have like symbolism. Apparently, they were taken from the Thomas Pynchon book, The Crying of Lot 49. I'm not familiar with him. I know he's a very highly regarded author. Most notably, the company name Yoyodyne itself was Pynchon's thinly veiled reference to Rocketdyne, a major defense industry contractor and manufacturer of rocket engines in the novel Gravity's Rainbow. So,
unfamiliar.
Evidently, this Rausch guy was a Pynchon fan to have lifted some of these things in homage. I'm sure he wasn't plagiarizing. I think he was doing it in homage of him.
Yeah.
So,
you had Flash Gordon. I've got pulp comics in general. The whole thing of this week he's an astrophysicist, next week he's a rock star, you know, kind of the way they would just switch out pulp comics to make whatever they thought would be cool for this particular story work.
Do you think it's pulp comics or pulp novels?
More the comics. I feel, even though I wasn't a big comic reader, I feel that kind of way from watching it. Like, that's what my assumption of pulp comics is.
Yeah, I agree. Because I mentioned that earlier, too. Yeah.
You know, he's a millionaire, playboy, philanthropist, you know, whatever sort of thing.
That's why it feels like it's inspired from earlier
definitely.
On when I said that. Yeah.
Agree.
Even though
totally
it's not.
That.
Yeah.
I also have Wes Anderson in all of his movies because they have such a distinct color palette and such weird freaking characters. And that's what this has too, I think.
So we need to just make a list of weird directors.
Yes, just all the weird directors are who this.
What's movie that? Hal Ashby. He did Harold and Maude, right?
Oh yeah, but that's very '60s. That's different. That's or you know, if you're going to do that, then you could say you know Sharman doing you know Rocky Horror. So
I mean, right. And there are elements of Rocky Horror in this. Now that you say it.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, just the strange set pieces and effects.
Mm-hmm.
Although no sequel was produced, you know, they hinted at one at the end of this.
Yep.
The lore, as I mentioned, has been expanded in comic books by Moonstone Books, which began publishing in 2006. So it's still kind of out there resonating in the comic book world.
Yep. I had mentioned Doctor Who. So I do think that's a definite.
I agree with that for sure. This.
And also, you actually inspired me. You mentioned the kiss and the you know he's still ionized as he says when he kisses her and brings her back, literally brings her back to life. That's very cliche. Princess Bride, Matrix, all of that. You know, one kiss is you know Sleeping Beauty, whatever. But definitely Matrix. That's my big. One of my big gripes about Matrix, the third movie ending is with, you know, well, the first movie and the third movie both end with a love conquers all kiss to revive the person kind of thing. So there's that.
Cliche. The last one I have is that in Ready Player One, the character of Wade Watts dresses his virtual avatar as. In Buckaroo Banzai's gray coat.
Buckaroo Banzai, yeah, that's true.
And we covered Ready Player One a couple seasons back.
We did.
Yeah. And that's all I have. That's all she wrote.
I'm just looking at my notes, and the only one I have that's worth mentioning is I did kind of like when they suddenly said the Blue Blazer regulars, and it's this whole collection of youth or kids that are like Boy Scouts, but they're Buckaroo Banzai Boy Scouts. I thought that was pretty cool.
K-pop.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very strange.
So, yeah. It's definitely not a movie for everybody. I would agree.
So I really want to hear from folks out there. Yes. If you like this movie, you need to let us know why. And if you really like this movie, I want you to go for the blood. Come on, bring it.
Yeah, and the hell would you like this movie?
I don't like this movie, and it's actually been one. There's usually one on our list every year that I'm dreading, and I think it was this one this year. I don't think either one of us.
We're over it now for you.
Yes, we are over the hump. I do not. I mean, I agree with the fact that it's not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die. If you disagree or you have opinions, we would love to hear them in the comments below. While you're down there, please. Subscribe. If you are listening to us instead of watching us on YouTube, we would love for you to do a star rating. If you don't have time to write a review, any little bit helps, folks. We can always use it. David and I have been doing this now for 6 seasons, and we have other shows out there on YouTube, little short shows, as well as some subscription and bonus content on Patreon. And until next week, David, when I will be seeing you back in the land of indie horror.
Oh, yeah, because I've never heard of this movie before in my life. So it'll be interesting for me to watch it. Yep.
It's interesting. It's modern horror. Let's just say this movie is not that old.
Yeah. Is this a Shudder movie? Did it come from Shudder?
I don't think so.
Okay.
It may have been on Shudder, but it is now on like Netflix or something. It's out there. It's more than just Shudder.
Okay.
So, yeah, most Shudder movies are Shudder only.
I will have to watch it.
Been elsewhere. All right. And so I guess we've dropped enough hints. You guys will find out Thursday what it is if you're not subscribing to us on Patreon. And until then, I'll see you, David.
All right.
Bye. All right. Bye.